case number 09-1050, National Maritime Safety Association petitioner versus Occupational Safety and Health Administration et al. Mr. Freilich for petitioner, Mr. Baird for respondents.
Yeah, he told me right here. I don't know if he was. He is really nice. Mm-hmm.
Is he on?
Yeah, fine. He's yours.
May it please the court, I'm Francis Edwin Freilich. I'm counsel for the National Maritime Safety Association, the petitioner, and with me at counsel's table is Charles T. Carroll. I'd like to start with by making 2 points answering why the National Maritime Safety Association brought this litigation. We've got two major problems with the vertical tandem lift standard. First, it dramatically curtails future innovation in the industry, our ability to automate, move workers to safe locations, and increase the throughput of cargo while workers are away from that cargo. Secondly, and equally as importantly, many of the requirements as have now been established are impossible, make it impossible to legally unload some cargo. If the court sustains the government's position and the clients that I represent then comply with the law, within weeks, there will be disruptions in the maritime supply chain. Some cargo will have to be left on vessels, and that will impact the U.S. economy.
Is that because of the inspection requirement?
The inspection requirement is one that can be worked around, but we've got several other problems. The flat racks, which are talked about in the briefs, they are required for safety to be loaded at certain places on the vessel. We can't unload those under the OSHA rule, which means not only they would have to stay if we complied with the rule, but all the containers underneath them would have to be left. And that means if that one of those containers happens to have the auto parts that are going to a Ford or GM plant to keep that plant open, the plant closes down until that vessel can go somewhere overseas where it can be legally, the load can be adjusted and then returned to the U.S.
About what you said about the immediate inspection, because I thought there was a big feasibility problem with that.
There is a problem with the feasibility. It's one of many problems with that. And OSHA itself, page 57 and 63 in the joint appendix, which is the final rule, said that they recognized that the inspection was, quote, impractical. I believe that's just another word for it can't be done. And it, in fact, cannot be done either safely any time, or in most cases, it can't be done at all.
Well, another question I had about that, and I may not understand it, is there an inconsistency in OSHA saying you've got to immediately inspect all four of these connectors when they seem to be saying at the same time, but it's only the two, there are only two that are critical. And your position is all four of them are?
Well, our position is that as long as the workers are not in danger, then the only thing at risk if those connectors fail is the cargo. And the industry has been committed before this rule and after this rule to move the workers away so that if there is a failure, they're not at risk. All the rest of these requirements are superfluous if the workers are safe.
Let me get what I'm trying to get answered, and that is OSHA saying you have to immediately inspect all four of these connectors, and is it at the same time saying we've analyzed the strength and the weight and so forth of these, and there are only two connectors, the two at opposite corners that are critical, to our...
Well, as long as two of the four and they're opposite, I think OSHA said we believe that's sufficient. Again, over a 20-year period, there maybe have been 9 documented failures, and even that seems questionable. But what they're requiring be done, again, you've got these two containers connected. They're 80 feet above the deck of the ship and maybe another 50 or 100 feet above the dock. And what they're saying is before we can lift these two containers off connected, we've got to send workers up onto the vessel where they're at risk. These containers may be in between other rows of containers and somehow inspect those containers. And OSHA itself recognized that that inspection requirement is not safe to do and is impractical to do. But that's what they said has to be done.
I guess one can read this preamble as an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, that they won't prosecute any or bring any charges from ship to shore for failure to inspect. I mean, I grant you they should have written that into the regulation, but they didn't. But on the other hand, you have a construction by the agency that says that we're not going to prosecute any cases.
Well, that's not my understanding, Your Honor. And what I understand the rule and the position of the agency is, they recognize that they effectively banned ship-to-shore VTLs by this rule, and that certainly is the interpretation of the industry. To my knowledge, there are...
Because you can't do the inspection, you can't use vertical tandem lifts? Is that
correct?
I see.
To my knowledge, there's not a single marine terminal in the country today doing ship-to-shore VTLs because they've been effectively banned by this rule. Now, that we generally can work around, except we've got a problem. While it is exceptionally rare that the connectors fail and release prematurely, what does happen on a daily basis is the connectors fail to release. And so now we've got a problem. We've got two containers up on the vessel that the connectors haven't released. The way the industry frequently deals with that is we lift those two containers off, set them on the ground, and break them apart. This makes it illegal for us to do that. And so now, again, we've got a problem. We can't legally unload those containers. The vessel now has to go back overseas somewhere where they
can't. Is it illegal for you to break them apart?
Well, it makes it, because if they're stuck together, these they're connected on four corners by a connector. While it is rare for those connectors to prematurely release, it is not unusual for them to get stuck. They get exposed to salt water, they corrode, they hang up. And if we can't break one of those loose...
But why can't you? I'm trying to understand why you can't break one loose.
Because they get hung up, they're in a tight spot.
Wait, what is it in the regulation that prohibits you from breaking?
Well, it's not that the regulation prohibits it, it's if we physically can't, if they get stuck. Then the only option is to lift those two containers off together, which under this rule now is illegal.
I see.
So that means that not only do those two containers have to stay on the ship, but everything beneath them now can't be unloaded either. So again,
why is it just two containers that get stuck? Why wouldn't it be four?
Well, sometimes it is, but usually you can work down if the fourth and fifth container down are stuck together. You can work down to that fourth and fifth container.
Break them apart then? Break the fourth one off or the third
right.
one off?
Right.
Why can't you break the first and second one off?
Well, usually we do, but again, in a 6,000 TEU vessel, it is very common to have two of the containers that get stuck. It's a daily occurrence, and so that is a far bigger problem for us. And this rule, again, creates huge problems for the industry. But to go back, our view has always been that we're perfectly happy to move the workers away where they're safe.
Do you make the argument that it was an unwarranted or indiscernible, whatever the phrase is, departure from the proposed notice of rulemaking to what they finally came up with when they banned the platforms altogether? And when they changed the full two containers to empty
Yeah, they have several.
I don't see that.
Well, they have several problems. The way I would describe it, Your Honor, is they have a proof problem. Because they had a they have the burden of proof, and they have to meet that burden by substantial evidence. Because they made a radical departure in the case of Flatrex from the proposed rule to the final rule, they don't have evidence in the record concerning, for example, feasibility. And with no feasibility evidence in the record, the only evidence at this point before this court are the affidavits that we've submitted. They don't have any evidence in the record to show that what they proposed is feasible. And therefore, in at least our view, they cannot meet their burden of proof that, for example, flat racks, what they have required is feasible, and quite frankly, it isn't. It can't be done.
All right, so you're not making a no-notice argument.
No.
That's what I thought. You're making...
No, we're making a fact that an argument that they have failed to meet their burden of proof because they so radically changed in some areas that they simply don't, therefore, have the evidence they need to meet their burden of proof. I was going to save 5 minutes, and if it is acceptable, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Baird?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Edmund Baird. I'm here on behalf of the respondents. OSHA has regulated longshore and marine terminals operations involving intermodal cargo containers for decades. In 2008, after a lengthy review of the question, OSHA amended these regulations to allow, in certain circumstances, vertical tandem lifts. This amendment is well supported by the record and within OSHA's statutory authority.
Let me ask you this. I wrote down, just because this is such a complicated area, I wrote down a feasibility problem with the immediate inspection requirement, a necessity problem with the VTL standard in view of the safety zone requirement, and a substantial evidence problem or support for your analysis of the strength and weight problems if your two connector assumption is wrong.
Your Honor, and I'll just address my remarks in that order.
Okay.
The feasibility issue on as far as the ship to shore, I think is your question. And feasibility is a question of whether there's a reasonable possibility that a typical firm could comply with the standard in most circumstances. But the feasibility argument that they're making here is not that they can't, let me see, when they say OSHA has improved feasibility, it's not that people can't unlock these things or unchain them. It's just that sometimes, given the particular location of the VTLs, they might not be able to do it. That doesn't meet the burden.
What do you mean from the location? They might
from the
too
location.
High off the deck. Is it?
But when OSHA said it was impracticable, Your Honor, all we were saying is to put the container in a situation where the connections could be checked before doing a VTL from the ship to the shore might take several lifts, and it would take a lot of time, and it would just make the procedure not economically advantageous. That's not a feasibility question. That's just a business decision about whether the employer might want to perform this operation in this particular situation. The feasibility goes whether to the question of whether it's physically possible to do that.
Didn't the record show that these sorts of inspections were routine in the industry?
The industry did some inspections. I don't think that the record shows that whether they were done from ship to shore or not, or they were just done shore to ship.
Is it your position? I have to confess I sort of missed this, but is it OSHA's position that number one, in order to lift these things together, you've got to inspect it first? Number two, we know you're not going to be able to inspect it, and it's too dangerous anyway. Therefore, you can't lift them together. Is that?
Let me. I have two responses to that. First of all,
which one? Yes and no.
OSHA does not believe that it's impossible to inspect these things. It just would take a lot of time in the context of the ship.
I thought that in the preamble it also said that it's too dangerous to do.
Depending on how the employer might want to do the inspection, it might be dangerous in some circumstances. And note that none of what we're talking about has to do with the shortest ship lifts, and there's no sort of perception that it's impossible to do these inspections before.
What does this mean? Such inspections cannot be performed while the inner box connectors are attached to the containers.
That's right. So to do the inspection that's required, you would have to disconnect the two containers and look at the inner box connector and the corner casting to ensure that it's still sound before you do the lift. You'd have to take them off and take a look at them.
How do you do that if they're two things resting on top of each other?
Well, you'd have to disconnect them and then look at them and then reconnect the
I guess the bottom line is are we supposed to read this as standing for the proposition that since you can't inspect them, you can't lift them together?
That's the practicability concern that OSHA raises, that it won't happen because it's too difficult to do in the ship to
not,
shore.
Not that you're excused from, because you can't do it, you're excused from doing the inspection.
No, that's right. We're not excusing anyone from doing the inspection in that situation for the reason that
you
Mr.
You have to do the inspection even though we know you can't.
If you want to do a VTL. Now, you can still lift it off as a single container. And, of course, the industry does that all the time.
What if they're attached together?
Well, there are ways to disconnect the containers before the lift. And
which is safer, to get somebody down there to disconnect the thing or to lift the two of them together?
In most cases, it's probably safer to disconnect them. In fact, only a small fraction of lifts were performed under this as VTLs annually. 165,000 lifts were done by VTLs versus something like 25 million VTL TEUs in a given year. So the vast majority of intermodal cargo containers are transferred by single lifts.
There's no evidence, you agree, there's no evidence that anyone has ever been injured as a result of a vertical lift.
I agree, but we've been lucky in that regard, Your Honor. There have been 9 separations, and OSHA's engineering analysis shows that they can't be performed safely under all circumstances. And in particular, one method that industry wants to use, and their voluntary standard would permit, would allow triple lifts. And OSHA's engineering analysis found that wouldn't be safe by a large margin under the agreed margins of safety required.
What is OSHA's position? I think I know what it is, but I ask you to articulate it. What is the position of where the baseline is from which you measure substantial risk? Is it current industry practice, or is it what industry might do if they didn't follow safe practice?
It's what the law would allow, and so it's not current industry practice, and that wouldn't allow OSHA. If OSHA was bound by some sort of an industry consensus standard, it would be preventing from adopting standards that would allow it to go after bad actors, and that's what we're really concerned about here. Moreover, this court in the National Mining Association case said that you measure against what the unregulated state is, not what industry would permit, and so did the Third Circuit in the Hascom case.
How about this steel joist case that you both? I think you both submitted it by 28J. It's survival, shall we say, after benzene. I mean, we said in steel joist, you don't have to wait for someone to be killed or injured. Mm-hmm. It's prophylactic, and
right.
We relied on Whirlpool. And then benzene comes along, and says you've got to quantify it, and you've got to quantify it if it's one in a thousand or one in a million, that type of thing.
I disagree with that. And if I may, the timeline is off. Benzene predates steel joists by over a decade. And benzene doesn't say that you have to...
Okay, you're right about that. What I meant to say was steel joists did not discuss benzene.
I can't remember. I think they do, in fact. I'm not certain. But my recollection is the statement that OSHA need not wait for deaths to occur occurs in benzene. And benzene also says that the significant risk requirement is not a mathematical straitjacket. Other courts in similar situations have not required a quantification of the risk. And I point to the Alabama Power case in which the 11th Circuit upheld a significant risk determination on clothing based on a videotape. And the American Dental Association case, where the Seventh Circuit did not allow OSHA to impose workplace practices regarding blood based on its determination that being splashed with blood could create a risk of harm. And again, the Seventh Circuit there said that quantification of the risk was not required.
Okay, let's say it isn't then. But how have you proven that there's a significant risk, whether you've done it by quantification or not?
The Seventh Circuit, what the Supreme Court in Benzene essentially says in evaluating different ways to think about significant risk is if there's enough evidence to show that a reasonable person would take steps to avoid the harm. And we've identified four factors here to meet that standard. First of all, we've done this comprehensive engineering analysis, which shows that under reasonably anticipated conditions, all operations involving VTLs won't have the universally agreed safety factor of 5.
How about the fact they've been doing this for however many years and there hasn't been an injury or a death?
And I think we're fortunate. There have been 9 separations, and in addition, industry says that it has followed the requirements of the Gurnham letter. So,
hasn't the industry's response shown that they think there's a substantial risk here?
And that's another factor that OSHA relied on in finding significant risk. That industry itself has adopted its own safe practices to regulate this risk. That also shows that there's such a sufficient risk.
They've been working, and you all have gone one step further.
Well, it's been working, but there's still some problems with it, and surely it can't be the case that OSHA is forced to accept industry's determination of what's safe or not. And again, I would point the court to this problem of the three VTLs that no one in this country has been performing, so we don't have the safety record on that.
Can I ask you a question about the Gurnham letter? What is its status? I mean, that was a letter that was sent to a specific company. Did it then become the standard by which OSHA approached these issues for everyone?
Yes, it was a general statement of enforcement policy. Right. So we said that OSHA has the authority to bring cases under 5A1, the general duty clause of the Act, even where there is no standard. However, OSHA said that if an employer sort of complies with these requirements, we'll find that we won't exercise that authority. But again,
so the letter itself is addressed to Sealand Servicing, and it doesn't have any of the general language that you're referring to. Was there some later action that was taken that made the Gurnham letter of broader application than just to Sealand?
No, but OSHA's practice is to issue letters of interpretation as a matter of enforcement discretion to give the regulated community some idea of where it's coming from. But the next step was the commencement of this rulemaking.
How big a step between the Gurnham letter and where we are now?
It's not two. The current standard requires training, for example, that the Gurn letter doesn't. The current standard requires gives more definition to the sort of inspections that have to occur.
There's difference in degree, not of kind.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's exactly right.
You haven't gotten to the necessity of this standard in view of the safety zone requirement.
And I think that a petitioner's argument on this really misconstrues the intent of the safety zone requirement. But first of all, let me note that even if there is a sufficient stand clear zone or safety zone, all that would do would be to protect workers underneath or on the ship's deck or on the dock. It wouldn't address the safety concerns for the crane operator, which is implicated here, where there is a separation, and there's an example of this on page 1286 of the joint appendix. Where there's a separation, that can cause the spreader bar to move, and it can shake up the cab. Now, there wasn't an injury of the operator there, but that is another worker who is protected by the standard. But even apart from that, these are extremely fluid, complex operations, loading and unloading ships, which happen at high speed, because the longer the ship's in port, the less time it's out transporting goods and making money. So things move at high speed. There's several cranes that can be operating on one ship at one time, right next to each other, and there can be dozens of people supporting each crane. So there's a lot of room. Things are happening quickly. There's a lot of room for human error, and someone just adjacent to a safe work zone for one crane might lose sight of the boundaries while he's engaged in the press of his responsibilities for another crane. Moreover, it's just hard to calculate how big the safe work zone should be because when a VTL separates, there's opportunities for spinning and things could catch on angles and throw containers far. So it's not a foolproof method for protecting workers in this situation. And rather, it's better as a secondary protection.
It seems to me that you're encouraging them to go even faster. If now they've got to unload these things one at a time rather than two at a time, they're going to be flying through these.
And my response is that, you know, in over 95% of the times, they're already doing it in single lifts. So this doesn't really have much impact on this on that speed. I think what controls the speed is the technical abilities of the cranes, how fast they can move, rather than.
Can you respond to opposing counsel's scenario that this is going to shut down large segments of the transportation industry because of?
Well, I think not even their affidavits that they've submitted make that point. All they say is that in some situations there might be a feasibility problems. There's doctrines under the OSH Act to address those situations because there's always going to be some disconnect between what the standard requires and what's feasible in a situation. So if there's a greater hazard in complying with the standard, that's a defense that can be asserted in an enforcement proceeding.
One of the things that you're required to consider is the cost effectiveness of the measure, right?
Executive Order 12866 requires us. Yes, that's correct. Where there are two provisions that provide an adequate level of safety, OSHA is required to use the most cost-effective method.
So why isn't the safety zone more cost-effective than requiring individuals to go down into the ship hold and at great danger to themselves and inspect these connectors?
The safe work zone is simply not feasible. It's not as protective. As the various engineering and inspection requirements.
OSHA says, well, this is never going to happen because it's too expensive to have people go. But let's suppose somebody says, I think I'm going to send my workers down there to disconnect these connectors and inspect them because that's what OSHA requires. And yet, OSHA itself says that working at heights puts longshoremen at increased risk of falls.
So OSHA is requiring longshoremen to be put at increased risk of falls.
But again,
that's one way of reading this, isn't it?
I disagree, because they would still need to comply with all the other safety requirements for that procedure. So there might be, for example, a requirement that they tie off. And they can only...
Do you disagree with what is said in the preamble? You disagree that it doesn't put... that? Are you saying that it doesn't put longshoremen at increased risk of falls if they have to go down into the holds and inspect these connectors? You can't be saying that.
Your Honor, they can only do it if it would be safe under all the other requirements that would apply to that particular situation. I will say that
I find it really bizarre that OSHA imposes a requirement that puts longshoremen at increased risk.
Well,
in the interests of safety. I mean, that's really, you know, it reminds me of something Eric Severide. Do you know who he is? He was a newsman. He said that the main cause of problems is solutions.
Your Honor, there's nothing here that's forcing an employer to subject his workers to safety. If they want to do this procedure and they can do the inspection safely on the ship, they can do it. However, it's likely not going to happen because it just can't be done. The inspection can't be done in an economic and safe manner on the ship. So I think the court's concern with respect is a hypothetical one.
I'd like to echo something Judge Randolph just said, only I won't quote Eric Severide. I'll just simply say, this case reminds me of let sleeping dogs lie. You've got an industry standard that over a period of many years has caused no injury, no death. You've got OSHA saying, well, you can't do this. This is infeasible. And we're not going to, this isn't going to happen often with the height problem. And when I asked you about, isn't this just going to make them do single lifts faster? And you said, oh, well, they're already going fast. And aside from the fact that you've got two warring unions here, what caused OSHA? I can't figure out what caused OSHA to get into this in the first place.
It came out of a revision of the longshoring standard done in response to a revision of international law or international agreements governing these situations. It was in that rulemaking, OSHA was presented with evidence that this procedure creates risks, and it broke off the rulemaking to address this particular problem. Your Honor, this is not a situation, with respect, this is not a situation where OSHA is seeking to put people at more risk. This is a situation where OSHA has considered the forces that act on these containers. Using the very methodology presented by industry itself, it has done the calculations to ensure that these twist locks, which were not themselves designed for lifting, are strong enough to perform these operations, and most importantly, to ensure that employers.
Why the twist locks then?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Has anyone come up with a twist lock design for the situation?
The twist lock. International intermodal cargo containers are all very standardized. So the sizes are standardized. The holes that the twist locks fit in are standardized. The twist locks themselves have requirements that they have to meet under international standards. So OSHA's, and the only way it works is if everything fits together, right? People can't have competing cargo container systems, or else the whole system falls apart. So what OSHA said is, all right, we're going to use the industry standard twist lock and see how strong that is, and then determine what would be safe given the characteristics, the strengths of that universally used twist lock. So what we're doing here is largely codifying industry practice. There may be a few disconnects, and those can be resolved through.
You've effectively banned ship-to-shore vertical tandem lifts.
That's not current industry practice at all, is it?
Well, it's unclear how many ship-to-shore VTLs are being performed in this country.
I thought you said 100 and somebody said 160,000.
No, 165,000 total VTLs. So, but the large majority of those go from shore to ship because of the trade deficit. So there's more empty containers here in the country than there are.
Yeah, that was a question I wondered, and I didn't look for it, but since this is standardized, what's the situation as far as safety in Europe and Asia?
We asked questions about that, and unfortunately, the rulemaking participants provided little information about it. There is evidence that they are being performed in a few other ports, but there was no information provided on safety. So we just don't know. Is my short answer?
But if this is so rare, according to what you're telling me, then what's the purpose of putting these twist locks on every container?
They're used to fasten, to hold the containers together while they're on board the ship.
I see.
Yeah.
So they don't shift around in the heavy seas.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Do you agree that the West Coast, the Union, the Longshoremen and Warehouse International, has contracts that prohibit vertical tandem lifts?
My understanding is that that's not the case. My understanding is that the labor contracts in issue don't specifically outlaw this practice. What they do, and this is my understanding again, I don't think there is a copy of the contract in the record, but my understanding is that the contracts allow the union to object to unsafe practices, and they've used that that requirement to refuse to do vertical tandem lifts in most practices.
No vertical tandem lifts are being done in ports. Are all the ports on the West Coast unionized?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, and so no vertical tandem lifts are being done by members of this union.
That's again. There's nothing in the record on that, but my understanding is that they do them in occasion where they're necessary. For example, as Mr. Froelich explained, where they're two jammed together, they will do them so they can the containers can be shifted to a place where they can be disattached or unengaged safely.
Do you believe, you're speaking for OSHA, but do you believe that we have to decide the standing of the intervener union?
We believe they have standing. I haven't thought extensively about it, but these are unions that negotiate on behalf of longshoremen who, under this standard, could be required to do these operations. And it certainly, if nothing else, changes the bargaining environment in which they operate.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time does Mr. Froelich have?
4 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes, yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. Couple quick comments. First of all, NHMSA is not arguing that this is not economically feasible. We are arguing that it is not technologically feasible in a number of circumstances which will prohibit primarily the unloading of cargo, where we are going to be forced to either choose between violating the letter of the law or unloading the cargo. And yes, we may have defenses that we could assert after we had broken the law, but nonetheless, we would be required to first break the law and then hope that those defenses would prevail. That is the gravamen of the feasibility argument.
Is it that this is a facial challenge to the rule? Are there situations in which let's just talk about the inspection. The inspection is technologically feasible, although not all, maybe the majority of situations makes it technologically infeasible, but are there situations where it's technologically feasible?
We have done inspections for shore to ship, which goes to, I don't remember who asked the question, there have been inspections shore to ship, where you're starting with two single containers, you're putting them together on the shore side to load them. The inspection is feasible there. where it is not either safe or frequently technologically feasible is when it is being done up on the ship.
Why can't one be lifted up and then the connectors put taken off and inspected?
Even where you can possibly do that, it's frequently very difficult to get to these containers. They're on a very large ship. They're high above the ground.
Sometimes it is, but not always. Which leads me to the following question. And I don't mean to throw you a curveball, but there's a case called Reno versus Flores in the Supreme Court of the United States that says that it invokes what's called the Salerno rule with respect to regulations that are claimed to be inconsistent with the statute. And the Salerno rule says that you have to, in order to mount a facial attack against a regulation or against a statute, that you have to show that the regulation would be invalid in all of its applications. And what I heard you just say is that this is not invalid in all of its applications.
And
therefore, under Reno versus Flores, you lose.
Well, that would create an interesting problem because you've got 60 days under the OSHA Act to bring a challenge. And so that if you applied that rule in this case, you'd be left in a, you can't challenge it when the rule is issued, and then you're barred.
You are absolutely right. It's a terrible problem, right. but I don't know how to get around that language in Justice Scalia's opinion. And the other thing is that would there be any bar in defending an ad or defending a citation and arguing that the rule is invalid as applied?
You cannot challenge the validity of the rule after the 60-day period is. It's a challenge now or forever hold your peace.
Right.
And if I may move on to a couple of other quick points, and maybe this will help. One is significant risk and whether OSHA has met its standard. OSHA in the rule itself described this procedure, in a quote, as a relatively safe procedure. Again, so which is it? Does it pose a significant risk or is it relatively safe? And that's at page 62 of the joint appendix in the final rule. Moving to the Steel Joist Institute, if you go back and look at we did not submit that case, but if you look at the underlying rulemaking in that case, there are a couple of interesting things. First of all, OSHA did perform a quantitative risk assessment. We can't find any regulation, any standard that OSHA has ever issued in the past where they did not perform a quantitative risk assessment before this one. Yet neither we nor the court have any explanation as to why not here. And at a minimum, we're owed an explanation for why the agency.
One way of doing it is that, did you do this calculation? There were a million, according to page 62, a million VTLs and 9 failures. And you explained, but that means the chance of a failure is 1 in 100,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to perform, but then even then you need to know where the workers are.
I understand that.
Because that doesn't tell you what the risk to the workers is, and that's part of the failing of OSHA's logic, is they're talking about the risk to hardware and equipment. They don't take the next logical step and equate that to risk to workers.
We have a case saying that possibility of 1 in 200,000 injury is sufficient to establish standing. Now, we've got 1 in 100,000 risk of failure, but that you're right. I mean, it doesn't translate into injuries.
Yeah, it doesn't. And also, another interesting point is in the rulemaking itself, for steel joists, OSHA identified 5 deaths and a number of injuries that were identified in the underlying rule. So while the decision of this court says it is theoretically possible to regulate without a death or injury, and I can certainly anticipate a scenario where that would occur. A newly established procedure, just produced, OSHA comes in, does a quantitative risk assessment, determines that even though it's new, that there isn't, that there still is a significant risk of injury and death, that fact pattern could certainly occur. That is not this case. What OSHA can't do is use the language of this court as an excuse to ignore the 20-year safety history of this procedure. It has to overcome that to meet its burden of proof by substantial evidence, which it has not done in this case.
Has anybody, have you, and I just don't remember, made a point of the fact that you would do fewer lifts with the vertical tandem lift? In other words,
we did, and OSHA described, interestingly enough, in the rule, OSHA, in the final rule, OSHA stated that vertical tandem lifts are safer than single lifts, which creates the paradox that while they said this is safer for the workers, but rather than encourage the industry for doing to do more of them,
It's safer under the rules that they've required. They're saying, right?
Well, they've said in it's not clear whether they're talking about under the new or existing, but they say at page 62 in the joint appendix that vertical tandem lifts appear to be safer than single lifts, which is true.
Which column is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't have the column. It's on page 62 of the joint appendix. We can find it for you quickly if that's helpful. But again, that's been, and I would make one other comment. We're talking about triple lifts. The day will come in the near future as these ships get larger where workers sitting in control rooms will be operating cranes remotely, and they will be lifting 3, 5, 8 containers at a time. As long as the workers are safe, OSHA doesn't have jurisdiction. Again, we think the key to the starting point of this analysis is where the workers are located, something OSHA failed to do as part of its analysis. Any other questions? Or if not, we can find that for you quickly. Third column.
It says, yeah, similarly compared to risks of transporting single containers, whether containers are loaded or unloaded, the number of VTLs is sufficient to conclude that it is a relatively safe procedure. I don't know that they say that it's safer.
I believe they said when compared to single lifts, but if I'm mistaken, I apologize. I'll find that language for the court if you... We certainly made the argument in the record and to this court that it is safer both statistically and precisely as Your Honor said. If there is a risk with each lift, if you replace 100 single lifts with 50 tandem lifts, you've decreased the risk.
Before you sit down, I asked counsel for OSHA, I'll ask you, I thought you said in your reply brief that the union that intervened here has contractual provisions that prohibit using VTLs.
They don't allow the routine lifting of VTLs. They're the only time VTLs occur on the West Coast.
Is that because of contractual provisions,
yes,
or is it because of what Council for OSHA?
It's the interpretation of the contract.
Of safe practices.
Yeah, they have argued that, and there also is the very practical aspect that if you do half the number of lifts, it requires less time to unload the ship, and therefore there are fewer, you know, hours necessary for their members to work. I mean, it in part is an efficiency issue as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
This honorable court now stands adjourned until Friday morning at 9:30.